Hard Feelings by Mark Coggins is a bang bang thrill ride, says best-selling author Seth Harwood, who adds that the lead character of Winnie is a female Jack Reacher. Find it in ebook or trade paperback wherever books are sold. In this podcast, it's read by author Mark Coggins. Learn more about Mark and his other novels at markcoggins.com. Chapter 5. Winnie. Reardon refused to say anything else about the guy, except that they should go to see him immediately. He hurried them through the meal, dodging any conversation about long-term plans. She let him drive the Lincoln back to the trailer park, where once again he parked it next to the saguaro in the visitor's lot. He led them down a street that fronted the outermost ring of trailers, to a double-wide that was lit up like a government building, if the government had double-wide trailers crudely painted to look like UFOs. Beside the trailer was a 50-foot tower with a mini-masted radio antenna at the top. "It's past midnight," she said as they went up the walk to the front door. "Are you sure he'll still be up?" "If it's past midnight here, it's early evening in the South Pole. He'll be up." Reardon knocked sharply on the door, then yelled, "Hey, Ray, open up, it's me." A moment later, the door was opened by a stooped old man with a Santa Claus beard. Earphones flopped around his neck, and he pointed the jack for them at Reardon like an accusing finger.
"What do you want now? I had Jessica from Palmer Station on the line."
Reardon turned to Winnie. "He's a ham radio operator. This Jessica is the only woman on staff at a scientific research station in the Antarctic. He figures he's got better odds with a woman stuck at the bottom of the world with nothing but penguins to keep her company."
"But what about the men at the station?" she asked.
"They're not 20-something actors like me who are about to hit it big time in Hollywood," said Ray.
"Really? I would have guessed you were a young-looking 40 instead of a 20-something.
"I'm 82, but she doesn't need to know that."
"Let us in," said Reardon. "We've got something serious we need your help with." The old man waved them into the living room, where they sat on a couch draped with a Navajo rug. He went to sit in a wooden swivel chair near a hutch along the back wall. Floor-to-ceiling electronics covered the wall, and a large bullet-shaped microphone set near a radio with a glowing dial. "Ray," said Reardon, "this is Winnie. Winnie, this is Ray." Ray looked at her with obvious fascination and practically licked his lips.
"Pleased to meet ya," he managed.
"Charmed," she said, and turned to Reardon. "Are you sure this is a good idea?"
If she met him on the street, she wouldn't trust the crazy geezer to give directions to the library, much less diagnose and repair problems with complex electronics. "Relax," said Reardon. Ray was an engineer at McDonnell Douglas. He designed the avionics for the F-something-or-other fighter aircraft.
"F-4E Phantom II,"
corrected Ray,
"and I was the chief engineer on the project."
"When was this?" asked Winnie.
1960.
Winnie lowered her head to massage the muscles in her neck once more. She waved at Reardon to get on with it. "Now, Ray," he began, "I'm going to tell you a story that will sound a little fantastic, but stay with me. It's all true, and you need the background before I explain where you come in." Reardon began to describe the startup company Winnie's husband had founded to help patients with spinal cord injuries, but Ray quickly interrupted.
"Sure. Neurostimics. I read about it. Never really went anywhere, did it?"
Reardon looked at Winnie from under his brows.
"I told you so.
That's the company, Ray, but it turns out they had a prototype that worked very well. The prototype is Winnie here."
"You mean you have a spinal cord injury?"
asked Ray.
I'm a quadriplegic, said Winnie.
Ray took the headphones from around his neck and set them down next to the radio. He stood and walked over to Winnie.
You have some sort of neurostimulator implant?
Winnie got to her feet and turned her back to him. She lifted her hair off her neck and yanked down her shirt collar.
I have two implants, one just above the C7 vertebrae to transmit motor signals from my brain to a transceiver, and a stimulator below the brake to relay the signals from the transceiver to my body.
She felt his finger run over the first implant, presumably continuing down to touch the second.
My God, said Ray, your movements are so natural. What's this transceiver you're talking about?
She retrieved it from her purse. She pulled it from the crude protective sheath she'd fashioned and held it up.
Here, like I said, it relays motor signals from my brain to the stimulator. It's also programmed to send ancillary signals independently. Subtle movements to help me maintain my balance or keep a natural gait while walking.
Amazing!
Yeah, but it's not so amazing just at this moment. It's broken.
Broken how?
She explained about the intermittent failures, seemingly caused by jolts or vibrations to the circuitry inside the box.
I thought it might be a loose wire.
Ray laughed.
Now who's talking about 1960s technology? It's probably a cracked solder joint.
Can you fix it?
Sure.
She locked eyes on his to emphasize the seriousness of the matter. Ray seemed to gleam with amusement, which only served to agitate her further.
You understand this is very important to me, she said. If you screw this up, I'll be paralyzed again. I'd rather die.
The old man frowned, then brought his hand up to stroke his beard.
If you're so worried about it, why don't you take it back to the neurostimics folks for a tune-up?
She started to respond, but Reardon beat her to the punch. That's not an option, Ray, he said. Bridges have been burned.
All right, then you'll have to put your faith in Uncle Ray. If I get the box open and decide it's something I can't handle, I'll close it right back up. But I doubt that'll happen. The innards of this thing can't be any more complicated than your typical garage door opener.
She smiled in spite of herself at the mention of garage door openers.
Okay, how do we do this?
Let's go to the lab.
The lab proved to be a bedroom with a long wooden table shoved against the far wall. Scattered across the table were a smorgasbord of electronic components and circuit boards in various stages of assembly. There was also a lighted magnifier on a gooseneck, test equipment of various sorts, and two soldering irons resting on stands. Holes burned in the table and the carpet beneath gave evidence of wayward solder. Winnie took particular note of the magnifier and thought of a dentist she had as a child who required special glasses to continue to work as he got older. She remembered the painful jabs he gave her when his hand slipped, and she bit her lip. She hoped Ray had it more together. She handed him the transceiver.
Will you need to disconnect the battery?
Yes, he said. You can't test or solder with juice going through the circuit.
I'm going to lie on the floor then. I need to be in a safe position when you pull the plug.
Wouldn't it be more comfortable if you used the couch in the living room? Asked Reardon.
More comfortable for what? My head? The rest of me can't tell the difference. Besides, there's no way the patient is leaving the room during the operation.
She lowered herself to the floor and lay on her back, staring at the ceiling.
Let's get this over with.
Ray nodded and pulled up a chair by the table. He set the transceiver beneath the magnifier and used a screwdriver to loosen the pair of screws that held the cover. Then he promptly flipped it in the air. It bounced off the rim of the magnifier and cartwheeled down to a spot a foot from her head.
Jesus, she said, you're not exactly building my confidence here.
Sorry, I only meant to use the edge of the screwdriver to pop the lid off.
You popped it pretty good.
Reardon picked the cover off the floor and put it on the table. Steady on, Ray. What's next?
Gotta pull the battery.
All right with you, Winnie?
Yes, yes. Get on with it.
Ray fished the battery out of its cradle and disconnected it. The nerve tone to her lower extremities cut off immediately. Paralyzed. It was such an ugly word. She realized with a start that she might never get off this floor under her own power. She bit her lip once more and squeezed her eyes closed. She heard Reardon moving beside her. When she opened her eyes, she found him sitting next to her, holding her hand.
"You know I can't feel that,"
she said, but she was pleasantly surprised by the gesture. "That's okay," he said. "I can." She nodded and looked up at Ray. He was holding the transceiver close under the magnifier, turning it this way and that under the light. He set it back on the table and probed its guts with a needle-like instrument, checking the reading on an attached meter each time he touched the probe to the circuitry. It wasn't so very different than the dentist probing for cavities, Winnie thought glumly. When she couldn't bear to look anymore, she turned back to the ceiling. She distracted herself by watching the broken threads of a spider web hover in the ambient breeze. Then she heard Ray grunt.
"What?"
she and Reardon said in unison.
"The solder on one of the component leads is bad."
"So you were right," said Reardon.
"Yep, and you were too. This is definitely a prototype unit. The components on the circuit board are through-hole mounted rather than surface-mounted, which is preferred for production designs, and it's clear the leads were hand-soldered."
"So what's all that mean?"
"It's good news as far as repairing. It's much harder to fix surface-mounted boards that are wave-soldered."
He reached for the soldering iron closest to him and turned it on. The smell of hot metal filled the room. Ray repositioned the magnifier to give himself some maneuvering room beneath it, and then brought the iron and a length of solder wire down to the transceiver. A thin stream of smoke issued from the box. After a moment, he lifted out the wire, followed shortly by the iron.
"Done,"
he said. "That's it?" said Reardon. "That's all you got to do?"
"Yep. The hard part is figuring out where the fault is. It's nothing to fix. Give it a minute to cool and we can put the battery back in and test it."
Winnie spent more time with the spider web, waiting until Ray pronounced the transceiver ready. He picked the battery off the table and reconnected it. Her nerve tone snapped on immediately. She gave Reardon's hand a hard squeeze and he yelped in response, yanking his tenderized fingers out of her grasp. "Glad you're back to your old self," he said. She rose from the floor and walked over to Ray. She watched as he reattached the transceiver cover, but she shook her head when he moved to return the box.
"No," she said. "We don't know for sure that you've fixed it. We just know that you haven't made it any worse."
Ray frowned.
"I take your point. It's possible I soldered the wrong lead, or even that there were two bad leads. But the only way to find out is to subject the box to the same sort of jolts or vibrations that provoked the problem before."
"Exactly."
"That's fine in theory. The problem is this thing really isn't built to absorb shock. If I give it a whack or drop it on the floor, it may damage something else, and we'll be back to square one."
Reardon joined them at the table. "Could you put it in some sort of packaging to handle the shock better? You're the military electronics expert. Don't tell me the electronics on your 4F fighter stopped working every time someone had a hard landing."
"F4E Phantom 2,
corrected Ray. "What you said. How about it? Can you do something?" Ray eyed the small box in his hands and nodded.
"Sure. I'll need to get the right materials, but I can make it more shock resistant."
"That's great, but I still want to test if the original problem is fixed," said Winnie. "Let's take it back to the living room and drop it on the couch. If it still works after that, then you can do all the armor plating you want."
Ray snorted and pushed his chair back.
"You're the boss."
They trooped back to the living room where Winnie braced herself at one end of the couch in case the transceiver failed again. Ray stood at the other and held the box about 6 inches above the fabric of the Navajo rug. He let it go. It bounced slightly on impact and came to a stop.
"How's that?"
he said.
"Fine," she said, but that's not high enough. Drop it from 3 or 4 feet.
Ray gave an exasperated sigh and picked up the transceiver again. He was just lining up another drop from a yard or so above the couch when the doorbell rang. The three of them eyed one another as if they'd been caught in the middle of a burglary. Winnie jumped to her feet and herded Ray and Reardon to the far corner of the room.
"Who would be knocking on your door at 2 in the morning? She asked in an undertone.
"No one," said Ray. "Except maybe him."
He nodded at Reardon. "Well, we know it ain't me," Reardon said. He lifted his shirt and drew an old automatic from under his waistband at the small of his back. She recognized the gun as a Luger and realized he must have secreted it there before they left for the airport. It'd be swell if it was Jessica from Palmer Station. He pulled the toggle action on the weapon to bring her around into the chamber, but somehow I kinda doubt it. You have been listening to No Hard Feelings, a finalist for the Forward Reviews Book of the Year Award. Find it in ebook or trade paperback wherever books are sold. In this podcast, it's read by author Mark Coggins. Learn more about Mark and his other novels at markcoggins.com.